I'm speaking with Deepak Chopra and Leonard Mlodinow, authors of War of the Worldviews, Science versus Spirituality. Let me start with a very basic question. Why did you two decide to collaborate on this book?
Well, we met at a debate at Caltech in which Deepak was debating a fellow named Michael Shermer from the Skeptic Society, and they were debating about the nature of God, and questions of physics came up during the debate, and I was in the audience, and after the debate, the moderator recognized that I was a physicist, pulled me out of the audience during the question and answer period, and told me to ask Deepak a question. And so the thing that came to mind was I asked Deepak if he wanted me to teach him some physics to help clarify some of the concepts that he was talking about. And Deepak, to my surprise, very graciously, and to the cheers and applause of his followers in the audience, said yes. So we began talking to each other, and it turned into a friendship. And we, in addition to talking physics, quite often we would talk about these issues, about our different worldviews, how you attain knowledge, where it comes from, and our different views of the world. And we decided that would make a great book.
And Deepak, why did you want to do this book?
Well, one thing I did want to make sure that I knew more about how I would use the terminology of physics instead of being always metaphorical and creative about it. So I thought, Leonard would be a great teacher. After all, who better than to have as your teacher than the man who wrote two books with Stephen Hawking, not only Grand Design, but A Brief History of Time. And I also thought that this was an opportunity for me to explain subjective experience, which is consciousness and spirituality, because the two are different methodologies of looking at reality. One looks at the world out there, and the other looks at the inner world of the rich experience that we have inside ourselves, the experience of imagination and creativity, and not only knowledge, which Leonard spoke about, but actually how can we make knowledge into wisdom.
Well, let me jump in here. You call your book War of the Worldviews, and let's talk about these two worldviews. Leonard, first of all, what do you see as the basic outline of the scientific worldview?
Well, first we have to understand what science is and what it isn't. I think that's very important, and that's a big issue in all these discussions. And what science is a methodology for understanding the physical world. And by understanding, I really mean, or we scientists, when I say I mean we, whatever, the people who do science, what we are after essentially is to first be able to predict the result outcome of experiments. That's the goal of science, both to predict forward and to predict backward, meaning to, based on observations of the present, to infer what happened in the past. So when we say understanding, we mean understanding at a certain level. This does not give us a deeper understanding of the meaning of life or where it all came from, except in the sense that it relates to our physical theories. So the scientific worldview is a worldview based on observation, in which we've decided as scientists that we don't want to just philosophize or just use pure reason about the physical world as people used to do many centuries ago, but that we want to add to that reasoning observation and experiment. And we want to require of our ideas that they be testable, falsifiable, before we accept them. And then when we get an idea, we test it out, and we move forward that way by checking our ideas. So the worldview of science is, or the methodology of science, is one that's based on observation. And that's in contrast to other ways of looking at the world, which answer other questions, such as philosophy and various spiritual endeavors.
Okay. Deepak, how would you define the spiritual worldview?
Yeah, I will define it in a second, but I want to comment on what Leonard said.
Okay.
What Leonard said is extremely accurate, but how people interpret it sometimes can be a problem. So many times people interpret the scientific methodology as exploring the truth. And I would qualify that as saying that scientific methodology is a method for exploring partial truth. because everything we know about nature is not about nature as it is through science, but nature as it acts through a human nervous system, and also nature as it reveals herself to the questions we ask. And furthermore, science is based on theory, experiment, and observation. And these theories are conceived in human consciousness. The experiments are designed in human consciousness. The observations are made in human consciousness. So science doesn't address, or has not yet addressed, how do we understand subjectivity? Although there are now a lot of scientific research into consciousness, but they're indirect, you know, they're inferential.
So you're saying that there are some inherent limits in what science can reveal, or another way to put
it is
you are arguing that science cannot tell us all that is real.
Yes, and I'm also saying that's where spirituality comes in, because spirituality starts with who am I that is doing the observing? Who am I that theorizes? Who am I that designs experiments or observes or designs? And that the only way to do that is through looking at myself. Now, science does look at myself indirectly, as if through a mirror, but spirituality actually says, just as I can observe the external world, I can observe me, and I can observe me through observing my thoughts, my feelings, my emotions, my desires, my behaviors, my interactions socially and with the world of nature, and actually through meditation and contemplative self-inquiry, I can even go to an experience called transcendence, where I go beyond the subject-object split and recognize that nature is one, that the world is one. As far as nature is concerned, or the cosmos is concerned, an electrical storm in the sky or an electrical storm in my neural networks is not any different from nature's point of view. So I need to step out of this personal point of view and see if there's a deeper reality where, in fact, I see a sense of connection to the cosmos. And that, for me, is a spiritual and sacred experience.
Leonard, do you accept that definition or that understanding of spirituality?
Well, I think everyone has, you know, to find their own spirituality. So it's not a question of my accepting a spirituality. You know, people. My point of view is that science tells us, as Deepak said, yes, partial truths, at least observable truths about the observable universe that we observe. And that leaves the inner universe of the meaning of life and or the questions as to why should the universe be the way it is for everyone to decide for themselves. So I don't think it's up to anybody to say, you know, like they do in the news today, to say this form of spirituality or that religion is right or wrong. That's a cult. This is a, you know, this is invalid. I mean, everyone has, most people or many people have these deeper questions that they want to ask themselves about the meaning of life, and they have different ways of looking at it. But so these are, if science is a partial truth, the question is how do you fill in the blanks? And everyone has to figure that out for themselves. I tend personally to fill in the blanks, either to leave them blank or to fill in things that I can observe and test and verify in that way.
But I hear Deepak actually taking this one step further. The spiritual perspective is not just sort of what you personally bring to it, that he's also suggesting there's some deeper underlying reality there, an unseen reality, well, the way you write about it, Deepak, in your book, an unseen reality mm-hmm. that is the source of all visible things. So science...
From my point of view, you asked me what I think. I mean, I don't accept that. I don't see evidence for an unseen reality, but I have nothing against people philosophizing about it.
Steve, let me do an experiment with you right now.
Okay.
On the radio. So I want you to imagine that you're licking a lemon, and just squeeze the lemon and drip it onto your tongue. Do you have a biological response to that?
No, I don't.
Do you feel any sick?
I don't have a biological response to that.
So you when you're imagining yourself licking a lemon, you don't find your saliva getting secreted. You don't, right?
I don't, no.
Okay, I might have to try something else, which would be...
Maybe I'm just a poor experimental subject.
No, imagine a very... Well, this I won't ask you to do it on the radio, but let's say somebody is having a sexual fantasy, okay, and they have a biological response to that in terms of an erection. What I'm saying is that every mental event, and I'm giving you dramatic examples, has a biological expression. The biological expression is material. The mental event is subjective. But before you had the intention for that experience, there was neither the mental event nor there was the biological material expression. And the deeper reality I'm talking about is, you know, in perennial philosophies called consciousness. Consciousness that creates a subjective experience and also consciousness that creates an objective experience. So that both are two sides of that deeper reality.
Well, let me see if I understand what you're saying. It sounds like you're suggesting that consciousness, in some cases at least, comes before material reality. I guess, the way we might say it, the mind comes before brain?
Actually, I'm saying that consciousness comes before mental and material reality. That material and mental reality are two sides of the same coin. Otherwise, we would be postulating a dualistic world, which is untenable because it violates the laws of physics, actually, in many ways. If you say there's a mental and physical reality and the two are different, then what's the mediator? And what I'm saying is there are two ways of experiencing the same thing. You know, you have a biology and you have a mental world, and they're both, in a way, expressions of that deeper reality.
Now, I don't think this is the usual understanding of consciousness, or at least certainly not the understanding of consciousness.
It's not the biological...
The way scientists talk about it.
Yeah, then it's not the way biologists or scientists talk about it, but it's the way that has been understood as Plato's forms, as in the perennial philosophies of Aldous Huxley, and Emerson and Thoreau, in the sages of the Upanishads, in the Eastern philosophers like Lao Tzu, in Buddha's teachings. But it's very experiential. You know, it's experiential in that when I employ the methodologies that spirituality uses, and I'm not talking about religion here, I'm talking about observing yourself, observing your thoughts, feelings, emotions.
But when you talk
then
about...
Then you realize there's an observer there that is independent of what is being observed, whether it's mental or physical.
But when you talk about consciousness as coming before both brain and mind, is this another word for God?
Well, in my framework, there is only a singular consciousness. And I will say that that's been said also by other philosophers, of course, and so it's not my original interpretation. And Schrödinger, the great physicist, is known for his famous comment that consciousness is a singular without a plural. So, yes, that in fact, the goal of spiritual traditions is to experience unity consciousness and go beyond the fragmented mind. So your consciousness and my consciousness is being filtered through a separate kind of experience of life, but it is the same consciousness. You know, it's more beautifully expressed in poetry than in science. When, say, a Sufi poet like Rumi says, you're not just the drop in the ocean, you're also the ocean in the drop. So when you go to the deeper level of your own consciousness, you find that it is an expression of a more universal consciousness. That is also the famous aphorism in the teaching of Vedanta, which is also a unified experience of consciousness, which says Atman is Brahman. Atman means the self. The ground of yourself is the ground of existence, because ultimately there is only one ground. Subject and object come from the same ground of being. And by being, I mean existence. And by existence, I mean that which exists.
Okay, let me bring Leonard back into this discussion here. What's your understanding of this word consciousness?
Well, I think that Deepak's definition and the definition of science are two different things, and it happens to be the same word. But and that's okay, because it's hard to agree on what consciousness is, because science hasn't really come to an understanding in science yet of what consciousness means. Scientists who study the brain don't really have a good operational definition or a good precise definition, which we always look for in science. We're still exploring around the edges of that question in science. So, in science, we don't see any evidence for this kind of connectedness that Deepak is talking about. That's kind of a philosophical, those are philosophical ideas, which we respect. But what we look for when we talk about consciousness is our very specific processes in the brain. What happens in the brain when you feel a specific emotion, when you see a color, when you feel love? I don't mean to be saying that we're understanding through that the meaning of love, but just that the scientific approach is to say, how does the brain create these feelings? And what we hope in science is that by these tiny steps over many years, we'll eventually put together a picture which allows us to address, you know, the greater issue of what it means to be self-aware and to actually feel these experiences. You know, because the color red or love is not an actual tangible thing in your brain. It's a state of the system of neurons, and we'd like to understand what it actually means to feel those things, but we have to take one step at a time.
But the dominant paradigm in science, especially in neuroscience, is that everything that happens in the mind is a product of brain function, right?
Right. I think Deepak agrees with that. Is that not?
I don't, actually. Our experience of the world is the experience of color and form and sound and touch and taste and smell. My experience of the world is that it's a pretty messy, noisy, colorful, smelly place. My experience is not neural firings or neural networks. So when I'm talking spiritually, I'm talking about experiential knowledge, not inferential knowledge. And that's two different things. Science examines consciousness inferentially. And spirituality says, how can you observe consciousness when consciousness is doing the observer, is doing the observing? And the only way you can observe the observer is through self-awareness. So start with that and then look for the objective validation in neural networks.
Are you saying that self-awareness is somehow, that experience is apart from what's happening in the brain?
Well, is the question, is the mind a product of the brain or is the mind outside the brain?
And I'm saying both mind and brain are a product of an field of awareness, which is prior to subject-object split. And I have a great difficulty explaining this to people because it's not part of their framework, and yet it is the basis of every perennial philosophy and every experiment that we do subjectively in the realm of consciousness.
So you're saying this field of awareness is immaterial. There's no physical substance to it.
No physical substance to it. It's a field of possibility or potentiality, and as soon as the potential actualizes, then it's either subjectivity or objectivity, which are two sides of the same coin.
Well, you know, as long as the field of potentiality doesn't physically affect the operation of the brain, then that's something that's outside the realm of science. What all science can tell you is that the experiences that are reported by the mind are experiences that are produced in the neural system of the brain. For instance, it can get so detailed. One story I tell in the book is about a split brain patient who has split brain means that the patient has had surgery to cut the brain, the left and the right hemisphere, off from each other to control severe epilepsy. And when you do that, you essentially cut the person into two personalities. There's one story that I tell. A neuroscientist was interviewing a woman who had had this surgery and asked, how many seizures have you had in the last week? And her left hand says 2, and her right hand puts up 3. So the two parts of the brain disagree, and they end up eventually arguing with each other and fighting each other, and one hand tries to suppress the other hand. So as a scientist, what we see this shows, or as this neuroscientist said, is that this shows that when you cut the brain in half, you cut the mind into two also, that you, this person now became from one consciousness to two consciousness, to two consciousnesses, that each brain, each side of the brain is now an individual mind. So this shows you the connection between mind and brain, that the mind is a product of the brain. It's not coming from some other place and just being reflected in the brain, but really, literally, is the same as the brain.
Okay, Deepak, what do you make of that kind of experiment?
Yeah, well, listen, the material world has its source in an invisible reality. Now, I may phrase it differently, but, you know, in Leonard's book with Hawking, the statement is made that the universe arises and will continue to arise from nothing. Now, of course, the nothing has a very, very precise definition. It's a dynamic nothing. But nevertheless, the material world has its origins in a domain that is not material. And I'm saying so does the mental. If you can give the material world that the ability or description of coming from a non-material domain, why not the mental too? That they're two different expressions of an underlying non-material reality. Now, having said that, I think the subtle mental reality is what drives the mental, the physical reality. And the evidence for that is the field of neuroplasticity and genetic indeterminism, which says that by changing your habits of thinking and behavior and feeling and emotion and relationships, both social interactions, you can actually change the neural representations of that inner experience on the material level. We know that today, that, you know, every if you're self-reflecting, your cerebral cortex gets activated. If you're having an emotional experience, your limbic system gets activated. If you're having a fearful experience, your amygdala and your reptilian brain gets activated. In fact, there are now studies by very prominent neuroscientists on things like empathy. If I listen to you with compassion, your amygdala, which mediates fear, will actually start to cool down, so to speak, on a functional magnetic resonance scan.
So you're saying that our mental experience actually changes particular physical functions in the brain?
Unequivocally so. And in order to do that, you have to actually make protein, and in order to make protein, you've got to turn certain genes on. I have regular conversations with people who do research in this area, with geneticists, and they say, right now, as you and I are having this conversation, and the people who are listening to our conversation across, you know, the United States of America, we are affecting their neural networks, and we're actually turning their genes on and off, depending on the kind of conversation we're having. So, yes, every mental event has a neural representation, and every neural representation has a biological expression. Your nervous system, your immune system, your thoughts, your feelings, your emotions, your breathing and your heart rate are an integrated process. Now, of course, the methodologies of science say, no, I have to study these processes independently, when in fact they are correlated processes.
Okay,
well,
Leonard,
science doesn't deny that the mental experiences affect the physical brain, and that the question is really this question of the immaterial world that Deepak says is the origin of it. And first of all, I should say that the physical world does not come from an immaterial origin. The so-called vacuum state or the state of nothingness is the same kind of material state that the state of somethingness is, and it's not an immaterial state. And secondly, what's important to realize is that it's not just an idea that we have that we're saying. In common discourse, we just say it in English, but in physics, it's phrased mathematically, and it has a very specific and precise definition, and it's testable. And you can test it in the lab. For instance, if you put two metal plates near each other. It's called the Casimir effect. We can measure the force of the fluctuations of nothingness. So it's a very precise meaning and testable thing in physics. The idea that the mental world has an immaterial origin is not of that nature. It's a philosophical idea. It doesn't have implications that can be tested, and so it hasn't been tested. And so, from the point of view of neuroscience, there is no immaterial origin of the mental processes. In order for there to be one, one would have to, if there was one, people maybe would discover someday that there is one. But the way you discover that is to define that in a way that has practical implications that you can test and measure in the lab, and then go look and see if that's the way it works, and then we'll answer that question.
Deepak, is immaterial another word for supernatural?
No, I don't. You know, I think of immaterial means not having, in my view, and maybe Leonard will object to this. Hopefully. Give clarity to this. By immaterial, I mean not having units of mass or energy. So when you go to the Planck epoch, for example, which is 10 to the power of minus 43 seconds after the Big Bang and prior to what is called cosmic inflation, the laws of physics as we know them anyway, are not there. There are many theories, and and Leonard is a champion of something called M theory, which puts together many theories to postulate what might be there, but it's not observable, as far as we know, anything below Planck scale space-time geometry, either in volume or in mass or in terms of the laws of physics. Similarly, the experience of love or compassion or joy is not something you can measure in units of mass and energy. So I think there is an empirical world that we observe, but I also think that the observer that is observing the empirical world is not measurable, is trans-empirical, to borrow a phrase from another physicist friend of mine, and that even the trans-empirical world is not the real world. Only the transcendent world is real, which is beyond the measurable. It is what is experienced as both the observer and the observed. And by the way, this is not at all something I'm making up. I mean, I go to endless conferences where people talk about, the fact that material reality is an epiphenomenon and mental reality is also an epiphenomenon, and the only phenomenon is the consciousness from where both mental and material reality are experienced as subject and object. But the transcendent, the transcendent, which is the basis of all original religious experience. If you really analyze original religious experience, whether it's the experience that is metaphorically expressed in the Sermon of the Mount or in the teachings of the Buddha, there are three characteristics of that original spiritual experience. Number one is the experience of the transcendent. And transcendent means that which is transcending space-time causality and transcending the difference or separation between observer and observed. That's the first religious characteristic of the religious experience or the spiritual experience. I'm not talking about mainstream institutionalized religion. Okay. The second experience, the religious experience, is the spontaneous experience of Platonic truth, such as truth, goodness, beauty, harmony, love, compassion, joy, equanimity. It is the original morality that is not coming from rules and regulations, but from the experience of my inseparability with all that exists. And then the third characteristic of the religious experience is a feeling of being connected to something that's eternal, that's timeless, that is the real essence of all existence, that timeless domain which is our source. And these experiences can be experienced sometimes as poetic truth, As when, you know, somebody like Robert Frost says, eternity is in love with the productions of time, or as when somebody says, love your enemies as yourself, or as one says that I have glimpsed my source, or that love is the ultimate reality. These are not measurable in terms of units of mass and energy.
Okay, let me turn to Leonard here. What about these concepts or these experiences like love or hope, or let's talk about truth or beauty? We all have some sense of this, but are these beyond science? Does science have anything to say about these things?
Well, science obviously has something to say about truth. You know, there's scientific truth which means truth that we can verify by making observations, as opposed to psychological truth of the kind that Deepak was just talking about, of people's faith or their feelings about where everything came from or being connected to the greater universe. So to me, these are just separate things. And the questions of can love or compassion, is that, I mean, I think, you know, we should be careful that of asking of science questions that science isn't designed for. Science is here to tell you about a physical universe, meaning the universe that we can experience through our senses and through our minds, but which, given that we're experiencing them through our senses and through our minds, that we can design tests and observe and measure.
Well, that's an interesting question right there. Is that just what science does, to tell us about the physical universe, or is science there to tell us what is real?
You know, that's for everyone to decide, whether it's what you're telling us, whether what's real or what's not real. I mean, you know, you could have a perfectly logical, you know, idea that I'm the only one in the universe. Everything is an illusion in my mind. And, you know, I can't disprove that. And I just don't find it a very interesting speculation. So what I care about is, given, you know, whether that's true or something else is true or whatever is behind it, you know, what is going to govern my experiences of the world in the future?
But the reason why I ask this is it seems to me that one of the huge questions in the larger science and religion debate is how much scope we give to science. I mean, how much can science tell us about the world that we live in? And I think what makes a lot of religiously oriented people bristle is the sense that at least some scientists are saying that science sort of tells us, is the great arbiter of saying what is real and what's not. So, but Leonard, it sounds like you're not going there. You're not going that far.
No, and I know very few scientists go there either.
Dawkins does.
Well, okay, but some go there. But if you ask a working scientist, look, scientists are people who have awe and wonder at the universe around them. And we as scientists, in a way, we have even more awe and wonder than people who aren't scientists, because we're dealing with these wondrous things all the time. You know, the astronomers looking at colliding black holes or studying, thinking about colliding black holes, it's not something that the average person normally thinks about. And so, you know, we're driven by trying to understand what we observe. And, you know, the question of, well, is that really real? Is that an illusion? You know, how real is it? Or what does it mean to be real? You know, these aren't things that scientists really consider. I mean, all people consider them. So some scientists will consider them, some won't. But it's not really part of making you a scientist, isn't whether you want to consider that. You know, we might talk about things as being real, meaning that as we're doing science, we have to have a little framework for understanding what science is predicting. But these philosophical questions are not really the purview of science. And so to say that science should tell you what's real or what's the real meaning is, you know, those are people who are taking it farther than it should be or deserves to be taken. Science is a very, very, very successful way of getting certain kind of knowledge about the universe.
Let me ask a more specific question. Let's talk about love for a moment. It's something that Deepak has referred to.
Can I comment on that?
My question is, given what neuroscience, what brain science might be able to reveal about the brain in the future, will science ever be able to explain the experience of love?
Well, okay, so, you know, scientists believe that all the experiences in the brain come from physical laws, and everything in the universe does. And just a short correction of what Deepak said earlier. We do not believe that the laws of physics break down at 10 to the minus 43 seconds. We don't know how to combine. You know, we don't have a theory. We have two kinds of theories in physics today, quantum theory and non-quantum theories, of which Einstein's theory is one of the non-quantum theories, and we don't know how to combine those theories back that far. But all scientists believe that the laws of nature go back. So science is about the consequences, is about observing things to find the laws and then finding the consequences of the laws. So in science, if you find out what is the scientific explanation of love, that will tell you that love comes from this part of your brain, and when these neurons take the blah, blah, blah form, then you feel love, and oxytocin is secreted, and whatever else, you know, neuroscientists discover will be a scientific explanation of love. Now, the idea of what is the meaning of love, you know, is beyond that, and that's for us all to figure out for ourselves. So I think we have to be careful of talking about issues that science does not address, and pretending or that science does address those issues.
Steve, may I respond?
Yes.
So in this particular conversation, I did not say that the laws of nature break down at 10 to the power of minus 43 seconds. I was very careful to phrase it a little differently.
What did you say?
I said the laws as we know them don't exist.
Yeah, okay, they do.
Okay, but I had a conversation with another physicist and said, tell me, how would you phrase it?
I would phrase it what I said, which was that we have two kinds of laws. We don't know.
Do we know what the laws are at prior to 10 to the power of minus 43 seconds? Or do we speculate? Is there any way of verifying those laws or falsifying those laws?
We certainly do believe that there is a way of verifying and falsifying, because otherwise it would be outside of science. But just because this is a very important point, which we talk about in the book quite a bit, Deepak tends to fill in areas where science can't answer a question yet, and say that science, that this is a question that science can never answer. And that's been done throughout history. I mean, in the 1850s, the French philosopher Comte said that, for instance, the nature of stars is beyond us. Look how far away they are. They heat the Earth, they produce life, they give us light, but we'll never be able to understand them because they're too far away and they're beyond our grasp. We'll never know the temperature of a star or what it's made of. And about 10 or 15 years later, spectroscopy was born, and we can answer all those questions. And so in science, there are always going to be things, unless we get very hubris, you know, have a lot of hubris and think we've answered everything, there are always going to be questions that are, for now, beyond the purview of science. But the question is, does everything in nature follow physical laws? And, you know, and everywhere we've looked in science, whether it's in biology, whether it's in neuroscience, whether it's in physics, whether it's here, whether it's a billion light years away, whether it's now, whether it's in the past, you know, we've done very impressive experiments. We've looked, for instance, back to 10 to the minus 34th seconds of the universe, and we've looked at fluctuations of the temperature in the sky to a part in 1 in 100,000th, and we found that, yes, these things all do follow physical laws, everything that we've seen so far. And so as a scientist, we have no reason to believe that there are that the things that we don't understand yet are in principle not understandable.
Okay, well,
I want to come back to that. Do you concede that there is something called the unknowable to science in principle, not because of the limitations of technology, but in principle?
There are things that are unknowable to science. Let me give an example. You know, where do the laws of science come from? Well, how does science explain something? Science, whatever you want to explain, say you want to explain A, the explanation comes from some laws. If you want to explain those laws, that explanation must come from some other laws or principle. So in the end, the basis of science is going to be a set of laws or a set of mathematical principles. And that fundamental set that we're talking about is something, why is it there? That's something that people can speculate philosophically about, but science can't answer that question.
So you do concede that science cannot.
You an example. Yeah.
Okay. So we don't know why the laws exist. Also, do we know why the universe conforms to those laws? And do we know where those laws are written, except in our own consciousness?
I don't know that those laws are written anywhere.
Okay, so they're transcendent laws.
I don't know what that means, okay.
Coming back to love, you know, we can measure in the brain that oxytocin goes up, for example, when you're feeling that experience of love. But oxytocin is not the experience of love. You know, we can say that the temperature is 50 degrees or 40 degrees or freezing. It's not the experience of feeling cold or hot. You see, science needs consciousness to do its methodology, but consciousness does not need science to know itself. You need experience. You tell, you know, you don't need to convince somebody who's never heard of science what the meaning or experience of love is. Just because we can measure oxytocin or where we can see a neural network that corresponds to that experience, it still isn't the raw experience of life. And what spirituality seeks to understand is the raw experience of life. Telling me that oxytocin is up or down is not going to make a bit of a difference to my asking myself what the meaning of love is, how do I increase my capacity to love, does it have any purpose in my existence, or is there purpose in existence at all?
I want to follow up on that point, purpose. And we could talk about meaning as well, two quintessentially religious words. I mean, one could argue that that's sort of what a lot of traditional religion was about, trying to help us formulate our sense of purpose and meaning. And I guess the question is, is that just a private construction that we do? I mean, is that just something that we create ourselves, purpose or meaning? Well, or is there something within the cosmos itself that provides purpose?
Well, in our book, we talk about our human knowledge of the universe in four areas. We start with the physical world and how the universe evolved and what drives it, and then we talk about life and what it means to be alive and heredity and evolution, and then we go deeper and talk about the mind and the brain, the mind-brain issue, and finally God, which I would consider a separate topic from the first three, which are more physical universe. And in each of these areas, we talk about not just what we know, but how we know it. And in looking at that, the scientific point of view is that the laws, whether it's the physical universe, it's life, it's the neuroscience, have no purpose. Many centuries ago, people routinely believed that there was a purpose behind the laws. Even Kepler thought that the planets followed their ellipses because there were like little angels pushing them along, or that they followed the law, they obeyed the laws for the same reason that we might obey the laws of society. And over the centuries, scientists have dropped that because we don't see any place for that in the theories of science. If there was a need for that, we would put it in. We would be driven to include it. But when we actually do the experiments and figure out what the laws are that govern things, that just doesn't come up. So the laws of science are not driven by any purpose. They're just the laws that nature follows. They're not moving toward any greater creativity or through any greater intelligence. Things do not appear because of a design. You just take the laws of physics, you start with some initial state, you let it go, and this beautiful world arises. And to me, that's the real miracle.
Steve?
Yeah?
So let me again respond to this, because our lives, our personal lives, are driven by meaning, by purpose, and by the fact that we feel we have choice. A mechanistic explanation denies meaning and purpose and also free will in his book, Grand Design with Stephen Hawking. Leonard said there's no room in science for free will. So, you know, human beings languish when they don't have purpose, meaning, or choice. Helplessness, for example, or feeling that you have no choice, has biological consequences. You can die. If you have that, you have no meaning and purpose, your psychology and your biology is affected. We know that through many epidemiological studies in patients. Now, here's my basic question. Can a physical system process meaning? Let's say I say to you, I love you, and the person that says I love you is somebody you're in love with. That has a completely different biological response than if the person who says I love you is the person you're just planning to divorce. It's the same vibration of the atmosphere. It's the same sentence. It's the same electrical impulse that goes to your brain. And yet, in one case, your blood pressure goes up, your adrenaline goes up, and the other case, you have joy. In fact, you can measure that serotonin and dopamine and oxytocin go up. And yet, it's the same sentence on the mechanical level. In neuroscience, there is no mechanistic explanation yet for how we process meaning or purpose or even choice. In fact, it's not recognized that these are attributes of a mechanistic system. That's the problem here. A mechanistic explanation cannot give us, a mechanistic hypothesis or theory of the universe cannot give us the answers to the most important experiences that we have in life.
Well, I think the real question is there another realm that or another principle that controls the way the universe develops and the way our life develops? And in the book, Deepak argues that not necessarily a realm, but that evolution is guided by intelligence or a drive toward greater creativity. And I argue that it's based on physical laws. And he's right that what that means is that there's no free will in the sense that if the brain is, look, either the brain follows the laws of physics or it doesn't. If it follows the laws of physics, then I can take the brain at any given time and tell you what it's going to do at a later time. That doesn't leave any room for free will.
Does it loom?
Wait. So the question then is, you know, how does that affect we human beings? We like to feel, I certainly feel that I can make choices. If I walk into the street, I'm not going to step in front of a truck. I choose not to do that. And, you know, that's I'm not denying that I have that feeling. And there's a big difference between saying that on a molecular level, things follow the laws of nature, and that on a level of the way I experience life, on the psychological level of zillions of molecules working together, that I have the feeling that I'm making choices. It doesn't matter to me whether or not, if you knew the state of all my molecules 30 seconds ago, that you could predict that I'm not going to step in front of the truck or that I would step in front of the truck. What matters to me is that at the moment of the choice, it feels like I'm making a choice. And, you know, I certainly agree with Deepak that that human beings languish when they feel they don't have free will and they can't make a choice. And I know of many psychological studies that show that. So that's not really the issue. The issue is really whether there's some other forces or principles that guide things in the universe or whether everything follows laws.
Do you think creativity and imagination...
Creativity can come from a mechanistic algorithm. You know, 20 years ago, I wrote a learning computer learning program where a computer being, was supposed to navigate through some obstacles, and I wrote randomness into this being's thinking process. Okay, because that's how you learn, through randomness.
Imagination.
And let me tell you, from the outside, you can do a little a video of what this being is doing. That's exploring its environment and it's figuring out to get to the front. Right, it's going from one spot. Many steps forward, but it's got to get around obstacles. And what this thing did after a number of trials was it figured out that to go forward, it had to first go backwards. And if it went backward first, it could circle around and it could get there quicker than any other way by going forward. To me, that looked like great imagination and creativity. If you didn't know that I wrote the program and that it was a mechanistic, deterministic algorithm, you would say that, no, this couldn't come from such a thing, but it actually does. So when you say that it does, and when you look at creativity and imagination, what looks like that can often just be a lack of understanding of the system. And what's creativity and imagination to one person, you know, is just a normal way of exploration.
We're running very short of time. Deepak, the last word here?
Last word is Leonard is explaining, using data to explain experience. I'm using experience to explain data.
Oh, I agree with
me,
that.
For me, experience is much important than data.
And I agree with that too, but it's not science.
That's a good place to leave it. Thank you so much. This has been
Thank you.
Very invigorating.
Thanks.
Thank you.